First, I'd love to know, Jenny Bowker, who you are and how you got involved in Tent Makers of Cairo.
I'm a quilter. I've been a quilter for about 15 years, but I was also, well, I'm still married, but my husband was the ambassador in Cairo for 4 years from 2005. And so those things just naturally came together when I went down to visit the Tent Makers. I'd been there in the past when I was on holiday from postings and other places around the region and seen the street, and I got to know them really well when I was there to live in Cairo. So I started taking them to shows.
Gosh, describe the street for us.
Okay, you've got to imagine that it's buildings that were built in about 900 AD initially and sort of done up and done up after that. It's narrow. It's soft brown stone, and it has a roof over it, which is most unusual in Cairo. It's the only roofed souk area still around. There's slanted light coming in down from gaps in the roof, and so it's sort of always dappled and soft. There's dust in the air. It's a dirt road that goes through it. And the shops are about the size of a small suburban bathroom. They are full of light and full of colour because the tent makers cover the walls with their appliqué work, and it's all plain coloured fabrics but brilliant coloured fabrics. So it's a magical place to walk in.
Now, I understand that these tent makers have met with some rip-offs, with people printing from the works that they actually stitch.
This is something that started happening about 30 years ago when importers started to bring in printed cloth from China, and some might even be made in Egypt, I don't know, but it does look like the applique work they make for very big screens in the street and for linings of tents.
So you befriended the tent makers and encouraged them to diversify?
I was having a conversation with one of them one day, and he told me that his company and family and a whole lot of others had put money in together to try to take their work outside Egypt, and that they'd gone to an expo for furniture in Holland, and the people in Holland simply had not understood what they did. They wanted things like 3,000 cushions delivered next week, and it's handwork, so that was simply impossible. And they felt they'd wasted the family money and were very depressed about the fact that this hadn't really helped at all. And I thought, just stood there thinking, it's the wrong place. Furniture makers are never going to understand hand-done applique, but a quilter would. And so it was this feeling that they simply needed to be seen by women who understood the work that they were doing and would truly appreciate it, because I found it fascinating and I knew that other women would too.
Tell me what it is about the technique that is so unusual.
It's unusual that it's done by men. There are men in the quilting world, of course. In fact, a lot of them have gone quickly to the top. But really, it's just they're so good at it. They're so quick at it. They sew much faster than most Westerners stitch because, of course, they're sewing for a full-time income. And it really is a matter of they feed their family when they finish the work and not beforehand. So it's a compulsion to work fast for them. It's also unusual to work totally in solid colours. Quilters nowadays tend to use a print and then they'll match other colours to the print, and usually every fabric has a little bit of movement or colour on it. It's just compelling to watch them sew because they are so confident, so secure. We tend to use specialty tools, little narrow scissors with a special end on them, special fine needles. They use nothing special. They have shears that are 14 inches long and made of iron. They have these great crowbars of needles, and yet they do this perfect applique. And it's a bit of an eye-opener, realizing that you can do that without special tools.
Describe how you made the connection for them.
I was invited to work and teach in a show in Melbourne called the Australasian Quilt Convention. And I had been asked to do a lecture, and they'd chosen a lecture about the tent makers. And that was interesting to me that I was doing it. But to me, it was always more interesting to show the work. I didn't want to do the sort of talk where I was turning lights on and off and then holding things up in the middle of giving slides, but I wanted to show them the street and introduce the tent makers first. And I thought the best way to do it might be to hang some of the work in the entrance of the lecture area so that as they came in, people could see what they made so that then they could see it again at the end. So I asked if there was anywhere I could hang some work, if I brought some work with me. And the organisers asked me to wait a week while they worked it out, came back and said, yes, they'd arranged the space for me. It wasn't at the entrance of the lecture hall, it was an exhibition space, and they were giving me 35 linear metres, which is about 39 yards, I suppose, of actual space. And I thought, heavens, that's an exhibition. It's not actually just a few pieces in the entrance. Then I realised that what made the work most interesting and compelling for me in the street, that where they work, is seeing the men stitch. So I wrote again by email to say, if I'm bringing an exhibition, could I bring two men and would you be willing to give them a hotel room? They came back and basically said that they could already give us the exhibition space but not much else. And a group called Centerman, a gold mine in Egypt which was run by Australians, came up with a lump of money for two men's fares, two men's accommodation, food for them for the period, and we went. And it was just a blowaway success. Mm-hmm. Every piece of work was sold by halfway through the first day, and the men went back with money for the whole street, and it was really thrilling. We took work from every single shop, so everyone was represented, and that was just a magical feeling that it was helping in a street that was having problems.
That was the beginning. What has transpired since, and what is upcoming in Paducah?
Okay, we have now, the men and with me assisting them, have been setting up shows in a lot of countries. After Australia, we were invited to go to France to the Carrefour de Patchwork. We went to Spain to a small show in Arancina. We've had three shows in England, including the big Festival of Quilts in Birmingham. We went to a Durham University show, which is the only show that has not been in the quilt world, but that was incredibly successful and very interesting. We've since had a group go to Paris, but most importantly, the AQS, the American Quilt Society, has in the meantime arranged and through me signed a contract with the men, and this is with every shop in the street of the tent makers in Cairo. They've signed a contract to say that for 3 years the representative of the tent makers in America, that they are the sole importer of goods, and so for 3 years they have the right to import and sell work from the tent makers. And it's the first time for these men that they have had a guaranteed income of some sort for the next 3 years, and it's just been a major shot in the arm for the street. People are coming back who had left. Young ones are starting, and for a long time there hadn't been too many young stitchers starting. So it's been invigorating and exciting. And the show in Paducah will be a large show with a lot of work on sale and on show. And two tent makers will be there. Hossam and Tarek will be visiting. Hossam is from Hassan Al-Farouk's shop and Tarek from Al-Fato. And they will be there demonstrating. They have some English so that they can talk to people, and I'll also be there giving lectures about it.
Well, that's pretty thrilling, and it's got to, like you say, be most satisfying to have been responsible for a rebirth.
You know, I think someone would have done it if I hadn't. I just happened to be in the right network and there at the right time when they needed it. And it's just been, for me, a very exciting connection to my own work and my own teaching.
Wow, what a story. I mean, I read about you, but I didn't know that this was the whole street that you're basically
subsidizing. It's not a very big street, but there's 18 shops who are signed, and that's every shop in the street. It's exciting because really there are a few tent makers in other locations, but not many. And it's just exhilarating and exciting that we've been able to turn this around a bit.
Mm. What has been your perspective on the spring uprising? Has that made any...
It's made a big difference. Before this, tourists were one of the markets. Not many tourists find the street. Tourists usually have to be taken to places like this because it's not on the beaten track. It's only about two blocks away from the most important shopping area in Cairo, the Khan El Khalili, or the most important tourist area, I guess. But people don't find it. They don't wander out of that big shopping area. They have to cross a major road, go back through some fairly empty areas, and they don't do it. And tour guides will not take them there because the tour guide is very well aware that the men who work on a piece for 5 months to finish it cannot give them a cut of 70%. And 70% is standard in a perfume factory. That's what the tour guide pockets as his part of any purchase that's made by a tourist. So it's a very crooked and corrupt system. It's hard to fight. But the men have at least agreed on one thing, and that is that they don't pay guides. So the guides won't take people there. They lie. They say things like, no, no, it's closed. This is their closing day. We can't go today, and tomorrow you're going to the Upper Egypt on the Nile cruise. Or they say, no, no, if you go down there, you'll get hepatitis. Everyone is sick, and people get very ill. Or they'll say, no, it's dangerous. You'll be attacked. There are many men who have knives, and it just makes it sound like a terrible area, but it's probably the safest area in Cairo.
Oh, my goodness. So the spring uprising didn't have as much to do with anything as just the
practice.
Well,
it did in a way, because the tourists who found it, the ones who read to page 11 of Lonely Planet and find the street there, mentioned there, and that it's interesting, or people who've been reading articles I've written over the last 8 years, people who go and try to find it do find it usually. It's not that hard to find. And also, a lot of people come to stay with friends in Cairo. There's a huge group of foreign residents who live in Cairo, based in America or based in Europe or whatever. And their friends all come and stay because, of course, you've got free accommodation in a really interesting place. And they are reassured. Their friends will say, come, it's safe. You know, it's really a nice country. And so they're not too worried by the press in the same way, usually. But at the moment, of course, since the Arab Spring, a lot of those people are not coming. They're put off by the press. They're put off by parents saying, no, no, don't go there. It's terrible. Didn't you see the paper last week? And things like this. So a lot of the foreign residents' friends who were the major source of income, people would take their friends into that street. Anyone who saw the work would buy some. And that was a very large part of the income, and that has faded away almost completely.
What's the price range for their works?
In America, in the AQS shows, it's between $300 to $1,800 per piece. It's actually much cheaper than an American quilter would sell their work for when you look at the amount of time it takes. In Egypt, it's much cheaper than that, but we've had to add on the cost of shipping it in and paying all the duties. The duties are really very high to get work for sale into America. And that has been a complication. But, you know, it still is not that expensive for what you buy. The men get what they ask for. They set their prices, and we do not argue about their prices. We just pay them.
Jenny Bowker, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you, Kate.